You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robin Wright has been reporting on the Middle East since the 1970s. In her latest book, she uses her experience and knowledge of the region to assess the prospects for the future of pivotal countries like Iraq, Iran, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, the Palestinian Authority, Morocco, and the Gulf states. In the end, she sees a more promising future for the region than most other experts. The book is called Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to the show today. Hello.
It's great to be with you again.
And you sure don't look like you've been covering the Middle East for 35 years. But what brought you to the region in the first place?
You know, it's one of those assignments I landed by accident on October 6th, 1973, which was the day the Fourth Middle East War broke out. And as anyone who's ever been to the region will tell you, there is such passion, such history, and the region is so important to our own future that it's very addictive. And as a journalist, no matter where else in the world I was stationed, I always ended up back in the Middle East.
And you always wind up being a war correspondent, whether you plan to or not. You've covered a dozen wars or so?
More than a dozen wars and almost as many revolutions, to the point that whenever I landed someplace, trouble always erupted. And my father once said to me he would not go to Bermuda with me on vacation because he was sure there'd be a coup d'etat.
or a serious storm. What was the first war that you saw in the region?
That was the first war in the Middle East, yeah.
That was, what was that one?
The Fourth War. It's 1973. And I also did the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the Lebanese Civil War, the 1991 Gulf War, the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, which was, in fact, the bloodiest in the region.
And my sense of that war was that it was unlike any other war the world has ever seen. With the recent visit of Ahmadinejad to Baghdad, can we assume that Iran and Iraq have been able to move on?
I think they've been able to move on. I think the Iranians now feel that, particularly because a Shiite-dominated government is in power, that they don't face the kind of danger of aggression from a neighboring Arab country. But the bottom line is that there are still longstanding differences between the two countries. Iran is Persian, Iraq is predominantly Arab, and that's a source of ongoing tension and difference.
And there are also a lot of people who continue to their families lost a lot of members, and a lot of people are wounded and will live with that legacy forever, won't they?
I think that's true, and I think the lingering legacy also is one of the reasons behind Iran's nuclear program. The sense that the outside world abandoned it during a war when there were over a million casualties, and that Iranians feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Well, even now, there are a lot of people in the Middle East who are concerned about some kind of alliance between Iran and Iraq.
Do you know, I doubt that's likely to happen. I think that Iran has been involved in Iraq increasingly, in part to make sure that there are allies in power there, also to put pressure on the United States to leave. I think once left on their own, the differences probably would emerge. But there's Iran also has a large community of Kurds and a large community of Sunni Arabs. Any instability in Iraq has the potential to spill over into Iran as well. So they have a vested interest in making sure the place doesn't implode.
But so many of these countries have interests in neighboring countries. Lebanon seems to be of interest to any number of different countries. And it's had all those civil wars.
A 15-year civil war, and you have 17 recognized religious sects, all of which have a right to a share of power in its political system. This in a country 1,000 square miles smaller than Connecticut. So it has a lot of combustible elements. One of the things that's so striking about the current impasse in Lebanon, they haven't been able to elect a president since November because of political differences between the country's political groups, is that it has not imploded again into a renewal of civil war.
Well, is civil war a major problem here everywhere? For example, we saw a civil war in Jordan years back. There's the Lebanese civil war. Right now, some people are saying there's a civil war in Iraq. And the Kurds have been fighting what might be seen as civil wars in any number of countries. Or are those rebellions something different?
I think a lot of them are rebellions. Civil war is usually when the central government collapses into, as we saw in our own civil war, into rival parts that begin fighting each other with their own armies. You can debate even the issue of whether there is a proper civil war in Iraq or whether it's ethnic and religious tensions. Much of the Middle East, the modern Middle East, was drawn up by the Europeans, particularly the British and the French, and the boundaries are artificial. Whatever happens to Iraq, I think, will have an impact on other countries. What strikes me, however, is that there are a large number of people in Iraq who do have an Iraqi identity, even if they think of themselves as Kurds, Shiites, or Sunnis first. Being an Iraqi is recognition of common security needs, common currency, the inability of the Kurds, for example, to exist economically as an enclave if they broke away from Iraq because they'd be reliant on Iran and Turkey. So there is some prospect of hope in Iraq.
My guest is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Her latest book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, which is published by the Penguin Press. And much of this is drawn from firsthand interviews. How are you, and I'll throw in a woman, able to gain access to so many powerful people in this region?
Well, when you've been doing it for 35 years, it helps a lot. I went back.
They know your name?
Some of them do. I went back in part because I think one of our central failures in Iraq was understanding what was going on inside the country when we invaded. We were relying on a group of exiles headed by a man, Ahmed Chalabi, well known in the United States, who had not been to Iraq since he left as a teenager in 1958. And I think that in the aftermath, we have to, because the Middle East will continue to be important for our own security and economic needs, we really need to begin understanding what's going on inside these countries. And so I went back to talk to the full array of actors, from the democratic activists who do offer some hope to the leaders of Hezbollah in Lebanon and the leader of Hamas in Syria, the Ayatollahs in Iran. And I guess because I had some time and I'm willing to listen, and a lot of them, that's all they ask for is to make their case, I had, unusual access.
Do you speak Arabic?
I understand a little bit of Arabic. When I lived in the region for 5 years, I got to the point that I understood a lot. I can't conjugate verbs and would not cover a press conference.
You begin your chapter on Egypt with someone at the grassroots level, a middle-aged soccer mom for Ghada Shabender in Cairo. What was she able to tell you about the political situation in Egypt?
I was really struck by people like Ghada, again, a soccer mom, as you point out, mother of four athletic children, in the middle of a divorce, never voted, never been a member of a party, had gone back to school to get a teaching certificate, had her hands full. And yet she symbolized the kind of awakening that's happening in the region. People, because of demographics, because of access to information, because of deep frustration and a knowledge of what's happened in change in other parts of the world, have become active themselves. And she saw on the new satellite television stations that circumvent the state-controlled media in Egypt pictures of a group of women protesters who were being beaten up by a group of thugs with a row of policemen watching. And she was really outraged. So a week later, she went down and joined the protest. And she was very funny. She told me the story of how one of the women recognized she was a new face and said to her, "Do you have 100 Egyptian pounds on you?" And Ghada said, "What for?" thinking there was a price for a protest. And the woman said to her, "For bail, of course." But she didn't stop there. She formed a group called We're Watching You in Egypt and watching the Egyptian government. And they started monitoring elections, putting out notice of what constituted election fraud. There were no international monitors for Egyptian elections. And they provided, not knowing what kind of impact they were going to get, they provided a new website, information, passed around 2 cell phone numbers for people to call. Didn't have a clue on election day if anybody would call. By the end of the day, they had recorded information on over 1,000 cases of election fraud. They then started hiring cameramen to go out with them for the following parliamentary elections and captured. The favorite trick in Egypt is that the government buses in its voters early in the day and then deploys police and thugs to harass voters for opposition groups. And they captured picture of voters being blocked from polling stations, getting a ladder to try to climb over a fence to vote, police opening fire with tear gas, and then rubber bullets.
But Hosni Mubarak has been called the last pharaoh of Egypt. He's more powerful than Nasser or Sadat ever were. Will this have any kind of impact? Isn't it most likely that he will die in office and then his son will become his successor?
That's certainly the way it's looking. The next generation or two will be shaped by the battle between the fledgling new Democrats with little background knowledge, limited resources, and little power, pitted against, as you point out, the autocrats who have no intention in giving up their control of the economy, of society, of the political system. And now the emerging theocrats who believe they have a mission from God and a flock of the faithful to tap into. So it's going to be an uneven battle from the start, with the Democrats having the hardest time. What struck me about what I saw, though, was that for the first time, you've begun to see new actors. I went out because someone dared me and said there are no Lech Walesas, the great legendary Polish leader, trade union leader, who helped bring down communism in Poland and that unraveled, in the end, the entire East Bloc. And so I went out looking for these new players, and I found a lot of them. It is a beginning, only a beginning. There will be no Berlin Wall moment. There will be no dramatic upheaval in the region that will automatically bring something in. This will be the most painful block of countries when it comes to transformation, the longest process, the most unstable from our point of view, because it will affect our own interests, not just on oil.
One of the people you interviewed was Nasser Amin, a 40-something lawyer who you describe as a cross between the Marlboro Man and a campus intellectual.
Yes.
Can he really represent any kind of future for Egypt?
Well, he's one who, as a lawyer, has started to help try cases, to help the judges, and the judges have revolted against the government in Egypt, which is really quite striking. It's the one independent body traditionally in Egypt dating back more than a century, and they got out when the government tried to disempower them from monitoring elections. And there were many cases in which people believe there were fraudulent results, and the judges cried foul and said things went wrong and there need to be recounts or re-elections and so forth, and the government acted against them, charging some of the judges. So the judges' community got out and protested against the government. That's, you know, when have you seen American judges stand up anyplace else in the world? Again, a beginning.
The judges also in Pakistan, by the way.
Absolutely.
I guess that's the one area where sometimes people resist. You said that Egypt can be broken up into the three broad categories, theocrats, democrats, and autocrats. Mm-hmm. But can't all of these countries, or practically all of these countries, also be divided into those three categories?
Yes, I think the next generation politics will play out among these three groups in every region.
My guest is Robin Wright of The Washington Post. Her book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, which is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Robin Wright, who is a diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She's also written for The Los Angeles Times. She's worked for CBS News, The New Yorker, The Sunday Times, and others, and won pretty much every award that can be won in American journalism. Her latest book is called Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, published by the Penguin Press. In your chapter on Lebanon, you write, two dynamics will define political change in the Middle East for years to come, identity And the second is the youth and emerging generation of younger leaders. Can you talk about both? Identity, I would assume, is an issue in pretty much every country that you've covered.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's interesting is most Americans look at the Middle East as Israel and then a block of Muslim countries, when in fact all of them are very diverse in their makeup. 10% of Egypt, for example, is Coptic Christian. They're Jewish Kurds. Lebanon has 17 recognized sects. There's a large Christian community in Syria dating back, you know, to the time of Christ.
And many of these are beleaguered communities.
Many of them are beleaguered communities, but some of them do have specially allocated seats in the local parliament. They do feel they want to stay in the country in which they were born. And clearly identity, particularly as societies open up, is going to be more of an issue. The more interesting dynamic, however, is youth. We've seen a sevenfold increase in the number of people in the region in the last three generations, from 60 million in the 1930s to 415 million today.
And 70% of the people living in the region stretching from Tehran to Rabat, you say, are under 30.
Yeah. And in some countries, they're under 25.
Isn't that also because so many people in the previous generation died in various conflicts?
No, not as much. There's a huge population boom. They're going through their baby boom today, and it's certainly changing the political debate and dynamics, because the kids are aware of what's happening in other parts of the world courtesy of modern technology. They're signed onto the internet. Even in places like Syria, there are internet cafes. There is a sense with the satellite television that what's happened with the demise of communism in Eastern Europe, the end of apartheid and minority rule in Africa, the collapse of military dictatorships in Latin America. And they are aware that they live in the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide. And there are a lot of them who want to see political openings. I think they're going to define the political debate over the next decade and define political systems over the next two or three generations. They are very frustrated. One in three is unemployed. It's the highest young unemployment rate in the world. And they have the same aspirations youth does anywhere: jobs, education, independent housing. And in cases where their aspirations are not met, they become very vulnerable to extremist movements.
You write of a T-shirt you found at a glitzy new Virgin megastore in the former Beirut Opera House, and it said, "We are different. We are Lebanese." They think they're different from other countries in the Middle East?
Well, the diversity. You have a society that where power is divided 50-50 between Christians and Muslims. It's always been the bridge between East and West.
But then the Muslims have to divide power as well. And
yes,
you have Hezbollah as an emergingly more and more powerful force there, representing a Shiite minority.
Well, but it's the largest, it's a minority in the sense that there's no majority in Lebanon. It is the largest in a plurality. And one of the frustrations for many Shiites there is that the Christian vote actually outweighs a Muslim vote, because the seats are divided. Everything is divided all the way down to state employees. It's not just members of parliament. It's number of police and federal employees and or government employees, local employees.
The deal that was struck when France left and Lebanon became an independent country?
Well, it was then six Christians for every five Muslims. To end the civil war, it was a new gentleman's agreement, which is 50-50. Now it's beginning to emerge on the table again that the idea of, should you open up and reform the political system again so that it's effectively one man, one vote, equally weighed, rather than skewing it or based on whether you're a Christian or a Muslim.
Will that resolve the problem?
Well, the Christians won't be happy about that. But I think that what's striking about Lebanon today is, having lived through five of the 15 years of that civil war, that there's a political crisis today, since there hasn't been an election of a president due last November. They've postponed it two dozen times at least. And yet we have not seen the country slide back into civil war. People are trying to negotiate. Again, I think that's even with Hezbollah as a major factor, even after the war with Israel in 2006, the fact is it has not slipped back into internal divisions.
You write of Saad Hariri, who was born in 1970 and elected to parliament in 2005. He says the problem facing Lebanon is, how do we strengthen our sense of belonging to this country rather than to just our religion?
Mm.
Can't that question be asked in most of the countries that you've written about?
Not all of them, but in many of them, yes.
Especially where there are many different groups.
Right. Lebanon applies more than any place else. But Saad Hariri is one of those who has formed a coalition. He's a Sunni. He's formed a coalition with Christians and others. The dividing line in Lebanon is less sectarian today than it is pro or anti-Syria. And that, in a way, is a kind of hopeful sign that it's not based on what your religion is.
But Syria supports certain groups. Doesn't it support Hezbollah?
Even though
Syria is a Sunni country and Hezbollah is a Shiite group?
But Hezbollah is also aligned with a right-wing Christian group. So the alliances are not always what you might anticipate, like in the old days.
Well, can peace ever really be affected if you have these individual groups that have their that are affecting alliances with other power groups and with other countries?
When you get down to it in the Middle East, the real essence of all of the tensions is political systems that are out of sync with their people, where leaders are autocratic and not opening up. And if they even talk about it, it's tokenism. What's striking is the number of people who are carving out new political space, challenging the status quo, challenging even the extremists. There are a number of people in Lebanon who, a woman, for example, a Christian, a woman, in trying to take on, out of the blue, never been involved in politics before, but after Rafiq Hariri's assassination in 2005, she went down to down to the site where he was murdered and helped mobilize through text messages, again, a new tool of political activism in the region, and helped mobilize over 1 million people who showed up and ended up peacefully getting the Lebanese government to resign and Syria to agree to withdraw after 29-year occupation. And she continues to be active today, but she organized a group of people who refused to leave until those two things happened.
Although Syria remains a real power in Lebanon, doesn't it? Robin Wright's latest book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. For your chapter on Syria, you begin with a trip to Beirut to meet up with a Syrian dissident to view a homemade documentary. Who was he and what was the documentary about?
The homemade documentary was about a man named Riyad Turk, who is the Nelson Mandela of Syria, and a very inspiring man who's been jailed over and over and over for challenging the rule of the Assad family.
Almost as long as Nelson Mandela, almost 27 years.
Well, the interesting part was the third time he was incarcerated. He was picked up at the age of 50, never tried, never charged. His wife was picked up at the same time. He had no idea what happened to her. He was held in a room the size of an elevator with no windows, no furniture, no toilet, no access to another human being, no paper, no pencil, no books. He kept his sanity by taking the uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night and during the day drawing geometric designs on the floor of his cell. And he did that for 18 years. And what did he do when he came out at the age of 68? He continued to protest against the Assad family, calling for the end of totalitarian rule. And he went back to jail again.
Well, why was he considered such a danger to Hafez al-Assad? After all, Assad had total power in Syria.
It's funny how vulnerable autocrats seem to feel, given that they have such extraordinary tools at their disposal. The security forces, they can pick people up and hold them without the rule of law. So it always baffles me, too. I mean, but there are, I think, the interesting thing about Syria, we pay so much attention to what's going on when it comes to the Arab-Israeli peace process, its meddling in Lebanon, or helping foreign fighters get into Iraq. But we rarely pay attention to what's going on actually inside the country, which is one of the reasons I wanted to take a look. And I was struck by how many people there are like Riyad Turk who are taking brave decisions. One of them, another man named Michel Kilo, organizing the Damascus Declaration, calling for regime change, getting 90% of the Syrian opposition to sign on to it. Very brave step. And, of course, he went to jail, too. You know, these are people who don't have to take these kinds of action. And yet, when I talk to all of them, I talked to Riyad Turk a few weeks after he got out the fourth time, and he's put it to me, he said, how could I live with myself if I lived with this injustice and I did nothing about it? And that's, you know, quite inspiring.
When you went to Damascus after Beirut, and this was your first trip there since 1981 when Assad was in charge. Now,
I've been back lots, many, many times to Syria.
And have you seen changes over the years? Has it changed a lot under the rule of Assad's son, Bashar al-Assad?
No. In fact, I think there were lots of hopes in the early days that the younger generation—
Because he was Western educated and seemed to be rather cosmopolitan. And we're always assured when some new dictator comes to power that things would be a little different because he's Western educated and somewhat cosmopolitan, listens to jazz or something like that.
He's an ophthalmologist married to a woman who actually worked in the financial market in New York. They gave the image of, you know, new breeze sweeping through Damascus and allowing access to the internet for more people and new freedoms and so forth. But the regime has been just as brittle and just as brutal as the regime of his father.
And when you first arrived for this book, you went to see Riyad Seif, who's a two-term member of Syria's parliament. Why him?
This is a man who, again, had, in the aftermath of the change in power from Daddy Assad to his son, decided that he was an independent member of parliament, and he organized one of the first salons where he brought together intellectuals, business people, the young politicians to talk about the future of Syria. What is it that they wanted? And they had lots of very interesting, sometimes fiery debates. The government got wind of them and began to close them down. He defied them, continued to hold them, and eventually ended up in jail, was released, but a few weeks ago was again picked up. This is a government that brokers no opposition. It's willing to take steps as ruthless as under Hafez al-Assad.
Of Iran, you write, Iran's Islamic upheaval is the only original revolution among the half-dozen uprisings that have rumbled across the Middle East over the past century because it introduced a genuinely new political ideology that altered the world's political spectrum. It introduced a unique and aggressive form of political Islam. How is that working out? What do you make of yesterday's election results?
It's clear that the government in Iran is not going to give much space to the reformers, who won only some 36 seats in the 290-seat parliament. There is a real nervousness at the top of the system about holding on to power. They felt threatened, particularly after the U.S., the clean sweep through Afghanistan and then the quick entry into Baghdad. And yet there is diversity in the country. And one of my favorite stories in the book involves a man named Hadi Khamenei, and he took on the issue of the supreme leader. Iran has a slightly bizarre or clearly unusual system where the supreme leader is like an infallible political pope at the top. He can veto legislation, reject candidates, reverse judicial decisions, and overturn presidential actions. And Hadi decided to challenge the idea of a supreme leader being above the law. He believed it is a position that should be elected by the people. And he, in his newspaper, as a cleric, he editorialized against it. He talked in seminaries and universities throughout the country, occasionally getting beaten up, having to be hospitalized. He decided to run for office. And even though he's a cleric, he was disqualified for not being Islamic enough. What's so interesting about Hadi's taking on this critical issue of the supreme leader and his extraordinary powers is that his older brother is Iran's supreme leader. So there is diversity in a country, even within a family. We tend to stereotype the region as all believing the same thing, all being with the same goals, and that just isn't true anymore.
Well, we heard for a long time that moderates were going to take over the country. That hasn't happened because of resistance from the supreme leader, but it does seem like it's only a matter of time. You saved Iraq for the last, and we've talked so much about Iraq as it is, but do you have anything new to say about Iraq?
No, I think one of the legacies of Iraq is something we don't consider, and that is the toll it has taken on democracy and the aspirations in the region, that people are very nervous about change because they fear a replication of the Iraq experience, opening doors that will lead to deeper divisions within society, potentially conflict between groups that had not engaged in conflict before, that the United States also will not be able in the future to push in the way we did in Iraq. Anytime we engage, even in a new administration, in democracy promotion, there will be fears in the region that we're about to impose something, that the lesson of Iraq is likely to be we're going to have to stand back and let many in the region take actions themselves so that change is homegrown and is not seen as coming from the outside world.
When you did an online chat with readers at the Washington Post, someone asked why you didn't include Israel. Is it possible to talk about the politics and future of the Middle East without talking about Israel?
Well, for the book, I went to all 22 Muslim countries and Israel to get a sense of what's happening in all of them. In the end, I picked seven that I thought were crucial in shaping the future of the region because of the tensions of change. I did not include Israel because it's such a vibrant democracy. And given the fact that it's a country, you know, about the size of Connecticut, it has greater political spectrum than even we do in the United States in terms of who's included in powerful positions. In many ways, the countries that I selected will have a greater say in Israel's place in the world and its security. I also didn't pick Saudi Arabia because I thought that the dynamics of change there were not sufficient to be included.
Well, some reviewers felt that in writing this book over the last 3 or 4 years, you were perhaps too optimistic in your outlook for the future of the Middle East.
I went back and, you know, after 2005, which was the Arab Spring, when we saw extraordinary moments when the purple ink-stained finger became famous because Iraqis went to the poll 3 times in ever larger numbers each time despite the violence, where we saw all these extraordinary moments in Lebanon and challenging Syria and forcing it to withdraw militarily. What struck me was I wanted to ask the question, were we back to square one after the autocrats and the extremists quashed that Arab Spring? And I came to the conclusion in the end, in fact, that there was a much greater realism about, after that setback, about how much it's going to take in the region. But they were not back at square one. The people understood better what needed to be done, what groundwork needed to be laid, and the extraordinary challenge ahead. But there are still people taking, I think, very brave and inspiring actions. It's a beginning only, though, and this is something that's going to play out for the rest of my lifetime.
Robin Wright's latest book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always great to be with you.